So in the last talk, I attempted to explore the area of individual Dharma practice as a way of opening up to the bodhicitta. And I tried to show that if we practice metta, if we live metta, then it will lead to profound spiritual transformation, even the bodhicitta itself. I tried to sort of show how metta leads through all the stages of the path. And metta is, of course, the first of the four Brahma-viharas, the divine abidings or the sublime abidings, which are also known as the immeasurables or the boundless states. And Mahayana tradition say that the Brahma-viharas comprise the bodhicitta. Some Mahayana traditions say that. And we have retreats, of course, on the Brahma-viharas. They're really important practices. It's interesting looking at Bhante's own discussions of and presentations and answers to questions on the different Brahma-viharas. Throughout them all, Bhante just emphasises metta, from what I've been able to see. He just keeps coming back again and yet again to metta. He seems to me to more or less say that if you have metta, then, you know, if you genuinely have metta, then the other Brahma-viharas will naturally arise. If you have metta, then naturally you will become compassionate. You will act with compassion when you encounter suffering in another. Naturally, you will be joyful, you will be glad and happy, and you will rejoice at the happiness of others. And it's interesting with equanimity, I think I mentioned this the other day, Bhante doesn't, as far as I know, refer to the traditional reflection that's used in the Upeksha Bhavana, which is, while in a state of metta, you reflect beings are the inheritors of their deeds. I might have got that wrong, but I haven't been able to find Bhante talking about that. Yeah, so in a state of metta, you reflect beings are the inheritors of their deeds. Instead, Bhante says that equanimity, peace, arises when one has the same love, the same metta to all beings. And I find it very interesting that Bhante's emphasised metta so much and has really encouraged us to concentrate on that rather than any of the other Brahma-viharas. It's almost like as if he's saying, concentrate on metta and the other Brahma-viharas will really take care of themselves. Perhaps if he was here, he might interject at this point and say, I've got it wrong. So, you know, this is me talking. Obviously, I'm not speaking for him, but that's as far as I've been able to see. I dipped into that big new book on meditation on the Brahma-viharas, and he seemed to be talking about metta repeatedly. But I asked myself why, and to me, I think the effect of this, to me, I think he's guarding against taking especially compassion and equanimity, those two in particular, in the wrong way. I think probably not, perhaps not so much of a problem with mudita, but maybe it is as well. But particularly I think compassion and equanimity can really be misinterpreted quite badly. They both have near enemies. Near enemies are especially pernicious because mudita has a near enemy as well, but I don't want to concentrate on that. But near enemies are especially pernicious because one can think one is experiencing a profound emotion when one is actually in the grip of something delusive and negative. Just to say about Upeksha, the near enemy there is indifference. And you can sort of see why. If you're reflecting beings are the inheritors of their deeds, you could just be, you know, just, well, that could lead to a kind of indifference. You don't, you know, well, you know, they're just experiencing their karma, you know. That would be to pervert what's really going on with that reflection. You know, you are having an insight into conditioned co-production in a state of metta. But it's very easy for people to slip into indifference. So I think it is one of the problems, actually, of Buddhism and perhaps a certain kind of modern Western Buddhist. And goes with, I think, alienation, a highly developed in intellect and an undeveloped emotional life, what has been called dragon's head, snake's body. You know, I think indifference is a real problem, and people think they're being equanimous when they're just actually emotionally stunted. The near enemy of compassion is pity. And it really is something to watch for. Pity is a sort of sentimental sentimentality about suffering. It's almost a kind of pleasant feeling that people can sort of see it when people are pitying somebody else. They almost feel pleased that they feel sorrow at the sufferings of others. Makes them sort of feel good contemplating suffering. Or it can be a sort of patronising and condescending attitude to the sufferings of others. At the back of it all can be a feeling of superiority in pity. You can even get that, you know, even be sort of told off for not having compassion. And the person telling you off is actually encouraging you to develop pity. Pity is also a state of confusion and ignorance. One can act blindly, foolishly, and can do even greater harm because of pity. Real compassion arises from clear friendliness, a clear state of loving kindness. And I think compassion, I suspect, isn't really a feeling. And perhaps it would be better if we didn't think of it as a feeling, that we thought of compassion, or even not even as an emotion, but we thought of compassion as the active reflex of basic, clear-sighted friendliness. Compassion just sees suffering and acts clearly and wisely, or rather metta, in a state of metta. You see suffering and you immediately act clearly and wisely to alleviate that suffering. The clear, wise action is the compassion, but you're not sort of, as it were, feeling compassion. You're just acting to alleviate suffering. And because compassion can be so problematic, I have to admit that I don't like using the term particularly. And it's interesting, I can't help thinking of what's described as the Buddha's compassion when he saw those beings as lotuses emerging, saw all beings as lotuses emerging out of the lake of the swamp of suffering. And it says that he felt compassion as he saw this. But the word that's translated as compassion, anukampa, literally means to tremble with or to shake with. I read that as not sort of the Buddha feeling sort of any kind of sorrow at the suffering he's seeing, but much more him shaking with the potential, the Buddha potential that he sees in all beings. So it's a positive vision of others' potential. That's the Buddha's compassion. So I tend to think it's better to concentrate on metta. And it's interesting, one of the very earliest Mahayana sutras, it really emphasizes the bodhisattva developing maitri, metta. That's the emphasis. And the translator of this sutra, this is the Ugra Paripricha Sutra, Jan Natia, the translator and scholar of this sutra, says that she thinks that in the earliest Mahayana, the emphasis is on maitri, metta, friendliness, not compassion. That's the emphasis. And she also believes that that means that there's an unself-conscious meeting of people where they are, rather than thinking and sort of looking down on people with compassion, so to speak. Very interesting. And that text I read from Shantideva, describing the Bodhisattva from the section on mindfulness, you just get the impression of a very, very friendly person who isn't going around thinking, I am the great compassionate one. There's nothing like that. They're just meeting people where they are and responding with friendliness. So I think we need to keep all that in mind when we're looking at Bodhisattva material, which does talk about compassion a lot. In his very early lecture on perfect emotion from the Eightfold Path series, Bhante talks about metta and the other Brahma Viharas, as well as faith, devotion, reverence. By faith and devotion, reverence, he says that's metta, encountering someone or something greater. It's metta, as it were, going upwards. But he also says in that lecture, to develop such emotions strongly, fully, you need sangha. You need spiritual friends. You need spiritual community. You need to be environments in which those emotions can flow freely, where you get the real opportunity to express them, those emotions, in their fullness, where you can experience a mutuality of loving kindness, and you can discover intelligent compassion. You can genuinely express gladness and joy and happiness at others' happiness, and you can have an experience of a sort of sameness of loving kindness for everybody equally. Where it's easy to express your faith and devotion, even to people who are more experienced than you, people that you can easily revere. So in that lecture, he says we need a spiritual community to be able to give full expression to these positive emotions, to really strengthen them within us. And it's very, very hard to make progress, real progress, without sangha, without spiritual community. And in this talk, I want to look at sangha. I want to look at spiritual friends as a way of opening up to bodhicitta. I think I said as well that this talk would be about the intensive practice of spiritual community as a way of opening up to bodhicitta. And before I go any further, I want to look at this word intense or intensive. Many years ago, on a study seminar, Bhante, as he often is, or was when he used to do questions and answers, was asked about what was needed for insight, what was needed to break through to reality, to break through to stream entry. You know, was it lots of meditation? And Bhante said a number of things in reply. He said, yes, doing more meditation would be useful, and yes, deep and repeated reflection on the Dharma would be important. But you also needed intensity. Intense engagement with the Dharma, with life, bringing the Dharma to your life. Whatever experiences you were having, bringing Dharma reflection and an intensity of engagement to those experiences, whatever they were. So all of you are fully involved in the Dharma. So how to generate that intensity, how to get intensity? Well, first of all, of course, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, of course, making that commitment and keeping going. Intensity doesn't, it's not about a sort of an incredible sort of burst and then you stop. That's not what we mean. You know, it's a bit like trying to boil a saucepan of water, and before it's got going, you just switch it off and then wonder why it doesn't come to the boil, why it doesn't change. It's a sustained intensity, if you like, over a period of time. And it might be better not to think from that point of view with this word intense. It might be better just to think in terms of sustained engagement, just keeping going, not pulling back. But you keep at it, you keep going, day in, day out, month in, month out, year in, year out. I remember in the Living with Kindness book, where there's a discussion of metta. Of course, it's all about metta. And Bhante just said, well, maybe people just need to do the metta bhavana more. If they're struggling with it, well, do it more. Just do it. Do it more than once a day. You know, if, you know, really, really crack it. You know, just really engage with it persistently. It's the only way we'll discover the meaning of these practices is actually through doing them, wrestling with them. Even, you know, Bhante was fond of that story that one of his Hindu teachers, one of those Hindu teachers, he was around about the 20th hammer blow on the rock. 19 blows, nothing seems to be happening, but the 20th breaks it. And you never kind of know when the 20th blow is going to come in the spiritual life, that, you know, the symbolic 20, if you see what I mean. I think another important thing here is always, you know, renewing our commitment, renewing our aspiration. In Buddhist tradition and Mahayana tradition especially, there's tremendous emphasis on aspiration. Almost as you could, you know, it's a real practice, forming aspirations, you know, being really clear about what you're wanting to do, really clear about your purpose, articulating it to yourself from the heart, not just as an idea, but from the heart, and regularly renewing those aspirations before every meditation, after every meditation, you know, renewing what your aspiration is. In some of these are, you know, just in very, very beautiful poetry. They almost seem like prayers that are being made. But, you know, it's turning the mind again and again and again to what's important. Always reminding yourself of your aim and purpose. Lots of words for intention, aspiration, vow, resolve. Especially in the Mahayana tradition, you can see what they're doing. It all goes back to, in a way, to the first verse of the Dhammapada about mind creating everything, mind creating our life, our world, our future. So renew and renew your commitment, your purpose. If you're really keen on developing the bodhicitta, of opening up to the bodhicitta, well, keep reminding yourself of commitment to gaining enlightenment for all beings at the beginning of each practice, at the end of each practice, especially perhaps during times of difficulty. I find this really important, you know that when I'm going through really difficult times, you know, and especially when meditation is difficult, well, kind of everything's difficult, or times of illness or whatever it might be, but renewing aspiration. I mean, I especially do this after difficult meditations, you know, where you know, it's just been, you know, just absolutely awful. And there's that, I mean, I don't know if it happens to you, but it happens to me sometimes. You know, it's just awful. And there can be that feeling, I can't do this. You know, this is a mess. You know, my back hurts, my neck hurts, my mind's all over the shop. You know, there's all sorts of negative emotions in play. What am I doing? Is there actually any hope? Is it worth bothering it? You know, should I just go and start that tobacconist on the Edgware Road? That was a joke that a friend of mine used to make quite often. I think he might have almost done it. But anyway, that's another point. But actually, at the end of meditations like that, that's when you should reaffirm your commitment very strongly. Okay. It seems I've been defeated here in this meditation, but I'm not defeated. You know, I'm renewing my commitment. I really do want to develop loving kindness. I really do want to develop wisdom and insight. That's what I want. It's very difficult for all sorts of reasons, but that's really what I want. So the Mahayana are very, very strong on this. Keep renewing your aspiration. And that will affect things, I've absolutely no doubt. Keep at least thinking of what your life is really for. I don't think we should underestimate this thing of, you know, that, you know, articulating, you know, sort of positive phrases in our minds. I remember there was a period in the movement where people were quite, it could be a sort of disparaging of the phrases that we're taught to use in the Metta Bhavana. May you be happy, may you be well, and so on. People say, oh, well, you just go off parrot fashion and, you know, you should try this and try that. And, you know, and there is something in that. But I remember somebody, I was doing a seminar on the Metta, and somebody said to me that they'd been through a very difficult period of depression. And they said just saying those phrases was a real lifeline. And it taught me that you cannot underestimate just thinking. Just thinking. You know, positive thoughts. Just thinking. You might not be doing anything fancy to do with imagining and all the rest of it, but just having in your mind those thoughts. This person told me it sort of saved them in a really difficult period. But we need more than the general aspiration of going for refuge, I would say. We also need a work, a life's work even. And this is something I think well worth thinking about. In classical Mahayana, after the bodhicitta arises, the bodhisattva takes vows. And there's all sorts of lists of vows in different sutras. And some of them are really quite, you know, well, they really are cosmic. And, you know, unimaginable. I certainly wouldn't be taking them. But it's I really love Bhante's discussion of the bodhisattva vow in his lecture series. He said, what the vows really are the way in which that individual bodhisattva, that individual person in whom the bodhicitta has arisen, it's going to be the way in which they're going to express the bodhicitta in their life. The way they're actually going to express the bodhicitta in their life, in particular work, particular activity. And I think he says something like, according to their interests, inclinations, the needs of the people and the needs of the times, the needs of the world in which they find themselves. It's as if the arising of the bodhicitta is the discovery of the master current of one's being, expressed in a life's work, suited to the people, the time and the place that you find yourself in. I think this is the way perhaps we need to think about it. It's really well worth thinking about your life. We are limited with our life. We haven't got, you know, as far as we can see at the moment, the kind of cosmos at our disposal. We've got a particular sort of shape and place and time and life. What are we going to do to contribute to the bodhicitta, to the work of the bodhicitta? Maybe we don't know what that is yet. Maybe we're in kind of preparation for it. Maybe we're still at the stage of learning and preparing ourselves with the Dharma. But there comes a point where I think a man has to think, this is going to be my work. This is what I'm going to do. It's very interesting. Bhante, in a way, discovering his own, or being, you know, his life's work being discovered, you know, because he has said that he felt he didn't start the order. It was sort of the responsibility, as it were, took him on, as he said in that lecture. And he said he probably, if he hadn't been asked to come back to Britain, he wasn't going to come. But he was invited back, and I think some friends in Kalimpong said, you know, he really ought to go back and, you know, teach the Dharma to people, you know, when he was invited by the Buddhist Society and the English Sangha Trust. He wasn't particularly interested. He'd gone forth from all that. And he said, if he hadn't been asked, he probably would have just gone on with his life in Kalimpong, where he was really happy, meditating, studying, writing, going down each winter to do lecture tours with the newly converted Buddhists. But it was as if something, in a way, you know, that master current was discovered. Well, you all want to enter the order, and some of you are order members already. You're all giving your life to the Dharma in some ways. But you also need to find the concrete expression of that in work. And essential to that is through the work of creating spiritual community, I would say. The work of creating and recreating the order. And I don't mean by that an organisation. Obviously, in a Sangha like ours, there needs to be a certain amount of organisation. But I'm not primarily talking about anything organisational. I'm talking about a living, vital, spiritual community characterised by metta and the other Brahma Viharas and so on. A spiritual community in which we draw out the best in one another, and we also do what we can together to expand the spiritual community, to embrace more and more people. But not like the growth of a religious organisation, nothing like that. But because we know individually, we really know and experience the value of the Dharma. We really do see it as the way to liberation and the solution to so many problems that are around us. And we see the Sangha as the way of bringing people together on the deepest possible level. a way of healing the divided and creating a living example of real harmony and unity through giving people the means for their flourishing, their transformation. So when we talk like this, we need to be clear that the Sangha, the real spiritual community, if you like, the real order, it should never be a sort of soft Buddhist support group, a bit of protection from the stresses and strains of life, or, you know, a nice bunch of people jollying along sort of thing. The vision of Sangha that Bhante has is of something much stronger. In his very, very early lecture on the meaning of conversion in Buddhism, where he talks about going for refuge, he talks about going for refuge to the Sangha means going forth from mere contact, mere sort of social contact, and going for refuge to communication. And by communication, he said, he didn't mean an agreement on doctrinal issues and things like that, but he meant a vital mutual responsiveness. I'm still pondering that phrase. A vital mutual responsiveness. A common exploration of the world of the Dharma in complete harmony and complete honesty. So this is what going for refuge to the Sangha sort of really means. We're highly attuned to one another. Highly attuned to one another's potential and commitment. And we're exploring the Dharma together. The Dharma is being discovered between us. The truth is emerging between us as well as within us. And real harmony doesn't mean always agreeing and being nicey-nicey. Metta can involve disagreement. It can involve all sorts of different views and responses to the Dharma. And it doesn't mean wiping out our individuality in relation to one another. We're all very particular and individual. And, this can lead, within the Sangha, can lead to real sparks and flashes between people. But we're all, if we're all aiming at that suprapersonal force of bodhicitta, the sparks and flashes are a necessary and brilliant part of the journey. Well, we can't generate that kind of intensity of communication, that intensity of spiritual community alone. Very rarely can people generate that on their own, or in our families simply, or in our workplace, or among groups of friends. Sometimes, even in our regular meetings with Buddhists, sometimes that vividness of communication isn't there. That's why it's so important that we put ourselves in situations where we're greatly stimulated. Sometimes, when we meet regularly with other Buddhists, it can all get very habitual, and we can just go through the motions almost of communication, which is a contradiction in terms. This is why it's really important to go away on retreats with people from other countries, other parts of the Buddhist world, the Buddhist Sangha, the Tri Ratna order, and so on, so that you get stimulated and sparked off, even challenged, inspired. So we need to be in Sangha gatherings as much as we possibly can. That's why in the order we put so much emphasis on the regular weekly chapter meeting of order members, order weekends, order retreats, the order conventions that happen every couple of years, all sorts of order gatherings. It's why we put so much emphasis on gatherings for men who've asked for ordination, because they're a sort of preparation for what you do in the order: study groups, going for refuge retreats, going for refuge weekends, and so on. So we need to do these as much as we possibly can. If we're free to, even live within a residential spiritual community, live with others who are going for refuge. If you can, even work with others who are going for refuge in what we call team-based right livelihood. These environments can be of very great value. They create that intensity between one another. There's a little aphorism of Banti's which goes, jewels are only produced by the collision of immense forces. So it's that kind of intensity between people, generated by individual spiritual practice, but practicing together, that can create bodhicitta. We create that consciousness that Banti calls a third order of consciousness, a consciousness that transcends individuals but is not a group consciousness. Very mysterious quality of consciousness indeed. Also a surprisingly ordinary experience as well. I mean, occasionally I think I've had glimpses of this third order of consciousness, usually in big order pujas, or in really heartfelt, intelligent rejoicing in merits, you know, done among a group of order members and mitras and so on, or working together to spread the Dharma. There's something very deep that develops. There's this sense of, well, yes, of going out of yourself and in deep harmony with one another, and yet we're all uniquely ourselves. Also, another thing that goes on in the Sangha is that individual efforts are amplified and magnified. You know, I think you can experience that on retreat sometimes. It's as if more is going on in your meditation because you're meditating with other people, for example. Or if you're studying in a really good study group, more understanding, deeper understanding develops because you're studying with others. And there is also that sense that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And when this sort of thing comes into play, there is this sort of transforming magic around. But these things, these moments of experiencing that quality of consciousness, it has to be said, these are moments of grace. Moments of grace, as it were. And much of the time within the spiritual community, there is just the work of communication. Yes, there are delights. There are wonderful delights. I mean, personally, I think I experience more delights than I do other things. But, you know, frankly, it's work. It's demanding because, let's face it, we're thrown together with people within the Sangha, very often with people we wouldn't have chosen to be with. Even some people in the Sangha, maybe many people in the Sangha, we'd rather avoid. I know people who've told me that if it wasn't for maybe one or two people and Banti being around in the early days, they would not have stuck around because they just found, well, they just sort of found people generally horrible. But, you know, the particular people they were encountering, they really just didn't like them. So if you feel that way on this retreat, you're in good company. Some of our most outstanding order members have felt that. But the beautiful thing and the awful thing about the Sangha is that there you are. You're on retreat with them. You might even be in a chapter with them, in a going for refuge group with them, in a study group with them. You even might end up living with them. You know, and they're the most awful people in the world. Well, you think, you're convinced. But you can't ask them to leave because they're going for refuge. And it's obvious they're going for refuge. I mean, they're not. You know, they're obviously doing it. You know, they're practicing. And you don't want to leave. So there you are. You know, there you are. Fantastic. I think Banti said, then you have the opportunity of what he calls mutual modification of being. Nice phrase. Rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? But in these situations, you need to discover real metta, real transcendence of preference. And there have been some remarkable achievements in our own Sangha. You know, I remember two people, they went off to start a centre somewhere and they discovered that they hated each other when they got there. They really loathed each other. But they worked on it and they are very, very close friends now. And they did start a very good centre together. You could even say spiritual community is a training in altruism, in real altruism, because there are no blood ties like family. not necessarily any sort of natural friends. So something has to emerge less defined by conditions. Yes, there is this common ideal, this common commitment of going for refuge, but you know, sometimes you've really got to work to be in, to stay in touch with that when your preference is sort of overwhelming that commitment. So Sangha is a really powerful spiritual practice. Much has been said about creating Sangha in our movement. It's one of those big topics. What more could be added? But I thought I would use try to apply a teaching to spiritual community. Not quite sure if it's going to work, but anyway, I wanted to talk about this particular teaching. And I want to mention it because you're probably not that familiar with it. What I want to tell you about, briefly, are what are known as the four root downfalls from the Bodhisattva vow. The four root downfalls from the Bodhisattva vow. This is from a very important tradition in Indian and Tibetan Mahayana Buddhism. And the background to this is that they developed in India, and it was carried through to Tibet and China and other countries, what is called the Bodhisattva Sangvara, or the Bodhisattva ordination. So as well as being ordained as a monk or an upasaka, so-called layman, you could also take Bodhisattva ordination, which would involve with different versions of the ceremony, involves taking the Bodhisattva formally from a spiritual friend, a preceptor. You know, and you would formally dedicate your life to gaining enlightenment for all beings. It didn't mean that the bodhicitta had fully arisen in you. It might be that you aspired to its arising. You know, so you took it as a sort of ordination. So, as well as taking the vow to liberate all beings, to gain enlightenment for all beings, you would also be taught, usually after the ceremony, a set of 18 root downfalls and 46 branch downfalls from your vow. There are different traditions of this, but the one that I'm most familiar with is 18 root downfalls and 46 branch downfalls from your vow. And really, they're a list of precepts, ways to keep your Bodhisattva vow in good repair. And Bhante himself was taught these by Dada Rinpoche after taking Bodhisattva ordination himself in the early 1960s. I'll just say a little bit about this. Sometime in the early 60s, Bhante decided to formally take Bodhisattva ordination. This is when he was in Kalimpong. He'd been deeply inspired from a very young age by the Bodhisattva ideal. He writes about this in The History of My Going for Refuge. Deeply inspired by it, and it had really supported him in his, you know, when he was largely alone working for the Dharma. He was trying in his own way to follow it in India. And sometime in the early 60s, certain things came together. It was the beginning of his work, particularly with the followers of Dr. Ambedkar, the new Buddhist so-called, in Maharashtra and Uttar Pradesh and other of those states in India. And in Dada Rinpoche, he said he'd found someone he regarded as a bodhisattva, a living bodhisattva. You know, Bhante said he met a lot of highly regarded lamas in Kalimpong in those days, but out of them all, he believed that Dada Rinpoche really was a bodhisattva. He said because he really observed him, and he said Bhante said, I am very critical. But he saw in Dada Rinpoche a life of total dedication to the Dharma, formidable individual spiritual practice and learning and wisdom. You know, Dada Rinpoche must have done meditations and rituals for about, you know, I think it was 4 hours in the morning and another couple of hours every evening. That was his sort of basic practice. And the rest of his time was just tremendous, tireless work to benefit others, especially through his school, helping those Tibetan refugee children and helping the Tibetan community generally. And Bhante said he never saw him down, he never saw him negative, and he saw a lot of him. And he also saw how badly he was treated, how obstacles were often put in his way, especially by the officials of the Tibetan government in exile. Tibetan Buddhism is full of politics. But he was never downcast or negative. He was always cheerful, always friendly, always kind, intensely practical. Very, very practical indeed. He said only one time he saw him puzzled. He said when at some function a woman was just really gratuitously very, very rude to him. And Dada Rinpoche was just a bit baffled that, you know, somebody could, you know, just be so rude to another human being. And, you know, we're very fortunate that Bhante installed a portion of Dada Rinpoche's relics in our stupa, because it gives us a connection with Rinpoche, with that, well, a living bodhisattva, and it's a constant reminder for us to, well, to really live up to the bodhisattva vow. Just say that Bhante no longer sees things in terms of separate bodhisattva ordination. He just sees that there is one ordination. There is just the going for refuge, and the altruistic dimension of ordination is, as it were, the bodhisattva vow. Interestingly enough, just so that you know, in the public ordination ceremony, there is a verse, sometimes called a vow, sometimes they're called acceptance verses or sometimes called ordination vows, the last of which is this: for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So there is that, as it were, touch of the bodhisattva vow in our own Dharmachari ordination, which is well worth reflecting on, and probably we don't reflect on it enough. So let's look at the first four of the root downfalls from the bodhisattva vow and see how we might apply, well, we're going to apply how we might apply each of them to our practice within the Sangha, within the spiritual community, how they might open us up to the bodhicitta. Each of the downfalls is preceded by the phrase, "It is a bad thing. It is a bad thing." Sorry, I know this might be, you might not like the language of good and bad, but there it is. That's the translation. It is a bad thing. It's a downfall. It's a falling away from the bodhisattva's life if you do this thing. And you'll see that we're dealing with it on a much more subtle level than the usual precepts. So number one, right at the top, the first one, it is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. It is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. So praising oneself arises out of comparing ourselves with others for our own advantage. It is speaking in such a way that we exalt ourselves, pump ourselves up, and we do so by disparaging others. And it can happen in a number of ways. You know, the very obvious negative way that it happens: we get together with others, we talk about others not present in a very critical way. Obviously, you know, we're doing it so that we can understand them better and help them, we say. But, you know, the implication is how wonderful we are. You know, we're talking about their faults, but the implication is the unspoken things that, but we're all right, aren't we? They're not, we are. Do only I do that? You're all looking puzzled. It might happen in other more subtle ways, by not giving due weight to the good work of others when we're being praised for something that others have played a part in. You know that thing, you know, somebody is praising you, but actually there's been lots of people involved in this particular activity. So, you know, you might be sort of, yeah, you know, I did that. When actually, well, you weren't the only person involved in that activity, in that work. I think that's another version of sort of praising oneself and putting others down. What underlies all this is that we regard ourselves as being more important than others. And I think there are also issues of status here. In some expanded versions of this particular downfall, of this precept, as it were, it says, with a desire for gain and respect, it is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. With a desire for gain and respect, it is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. One's concerned with status and position, to be seen as better and greater than others, and to have a secure position. A secure position. It's also a competitive stance on the world. It's basically competitive. We see others as in the way. We are the important one, the special one, as Jose Mourinho said of himself. He was the ex-manager of Chelsea, now the manager of Real Madrid. He calls himself the special one. And I think, well, anyway, let's not go into Jose Mourinho's psychology. So, and I hope I'm not disparaging, because I actually rather like him. Anyway, that's another thing. But this is very, very basic indeed. And probably it arises out of our own life struggles. Perhaps it's deep in our evolutionary past, when our genes or whatever we got left over from when we were, you know, battling it out in the jungle for survival. But if we're in this state of this basically competitive stance of praising ourselves, disparaging others, it's a complete rejection of the bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a state of mind in which self and other is transcended. The bodhisattva has a deep sense of sympathy with all life, a deep sense of interconnectedness. The competitive stance is a complete rejection of that. It's the complete opposite of that. Not that we disparage ourselves and praise others. I don't think that would be the opposite, by the way. We do need a healthy, straightforward self-appreciation. Sometimes people can have a very negative attitude to themselves, but that too will keep them apart from others and needs to be worked on. Sometimes even that negative attitude to oneself can lead to a desire for status and position in the Sangha. I've certainly seen this, where because people feel bad about themselves, they try to get it through having a position, through having status, through a very competitive attitude to others. But what they really need to be getting to grips with is that negative attitude towards themselves. Bhante himself has been very clear that order members have no status. A dharmachari, one who fares in the Dharma, does not have a special status. We're neither monks nor lay people. We can't label ourselves in that way. And Bhante on one occasion, said that no order member should describe themselves as a lay person. They might be a householder, yes, but they're not a lay person. That could imply something part-time. But we're not monks either. We might be living in a retreat centre. We might be an artist. We might be a solitary meditator. We might be a chairman, a mitra convener, etc., etc. But there's no special status that goes with that. We are just dharmacharis. We have to watch labelling. You know, saying, I am a teacher, I am a Buddhist teacher, or I am a meditation teacher. So easily that can turn into status. We are just dharmacharis, farers along in the Dharma, faring along in the ocean of the Dharma. You know, within the order, some order members, there are order members of very long standing, or order members who are Kalyana Mitras, who are preceptors and so on, but they don't have a special status. They don't stand, you know, on use those things as it were as a status. Your experience might well be respected, even revered, but you never turn that into a status or a position. In the Bodhisattva tradition, this is made much of. Actually, in the oldest Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Ratna Guna Sanchayagata, the verses on the perfection of wisdom, which are a store of precious qualities, there's this description of a bodhisattva: in form, in feeling, will, perception and awareness, nowhere in them the bodhisattvas find a place to rest on. Without a home the bodhisattvas wander. Ideas never hold them, nor do bodhisattvas grasp at ideas. The jinnas bodhi, the bodhisattvas are bound to gain. So instead of thinking in terms of status, of position, even of personal and individual attainment, we practice together in such a way as to create the living Dharma between us, within all of us and between all of us, as it were, so that we are all flourishing. We practice to invoke the bodhicitta between us and for the benefit of all. So that's the first one. It is a bad thing to praise oneself and disparage others. Secondly, it is a bad thing to withhold the wealth of the Dharma from others. It is a bad thing to withhold the wealth of the Dharma from others. Again, this is absolutely basic. It's a basic downfall for a bodhisattva. If someone's truly inspired and moved by the bodhisattva path, by the bodhicitta, by the Dharma, they will want to do all that they can to share the Dharma with others, with as many as possible, in as vivid a way as possible. If we're enriched by the Dharma to that extent, we should share that richness with others. We might not be ready yet to do formal teaching. We might have to be, you know, doing a lot of training before we can actually, you know, be the person giving the talks and leading the classes. You know, that's fine. There's no need to be in a hurry to do that work. But we can help others in the Sangha who are teaching. We can support them in classes. We can physically help out or help the centre financially. There's always a need for money to support Dharma work all the time. You know, we need more money. Sometimes we withhold the wealth of the Dharma because we think it will give us too much trouble to, you know, to help out at the centre or whatever. Well, it's good to put up with a bit of hardship to communicate the Dharma. It's good to do that. It's good. It's a good discipline. It's a good practice to go out of our way and for it to be, you know, to cause us a bit of trouble. Actually, you know, when you think of how the Dharma's been transmitted to us, I can think of all sorts of, you know, in the tradition itself, how much hardship, you know, great Buddhists have put up with to communicate the Dharma so that we can receive it. So we need to be in that tradition. If we're not involved in communicating the wealth of the Dharma, it could be that we're using the Dharma really rather psychologically. It's more to do with a sort of self-help thing. It's more like therapy, which supports a sort of comfortable, rather bourgeois life. Really, Dharma should be regarded as a revolutionary force. And bodhicitta should be regarded as a revolutionary force. It was very, very good living in India and, you know, immersing myself, if you like, in the life and sort of spirit of Dr. Ambedkar, Babasaheb Ambedkar, who I believe was a bodhisattva. I mean, he was incredibly critical of Buddhist monks that he met, apart from Bhante. Because he said, you know, they don't serve the people. They don't serve the people. They just spend their time sleeping and meditating, just having a comfortable life. They don't go out of their way to take the Dharma to the people who need it. So we need to see how the Dharma has enriched us and do all we can to enrich others with the Dharma. And work with others in the Sangha to enrich the world with the Dharma. I'm going to dwell on this more tomorrow. I love this phrase, the wealth of the Dharma as well, the wealth of the Dharma. You know, really, in the end, we need to be aiming to give people the Dharma in its fullest depth and its widest breadth and with its full force, at least eventually. I mean, you might not, as soon as they come into your group or your class, immediately give them the Heart Sutra or the suprapersonal spiritual force. That might, you know, blow them out the door. You know, sometimes, yes, we do need to, you know, gradually introduce, well, very often give people the Dharma gradually. We might well have to give people the Dharma to help people be comfortable with themselves and their world and so on. You know, if that's what people need, that's what you give. Obviously, you've got to tune in. But there are people out there who want the full transforming force of the Dharma. And they want it soon. They want it early. They do actually want to live a really full Dharma life. So don't ignore them. Don't forget that there are people like that. And they're suffering. They're really suffering because they're not able to express that. They're like caged tigers. Or frustrated tigers, you know, and frustrated tigers will do a lot of damage. So don't forget that there are people who want something much, much fuller, and we need to find them and connect with them. I mean, I was like that. I'm relieved that the first night I went along, it was 50 minutes metta and a sevenfold puja. I'm so glad it was. And it wasn't, oh, look, you know, be careful. Just do the first stage of the mindfulness of breathing. You know, be gentle. I didn't want gentle. I mean, you know, I've had to learn how to be gentle. You know, and all the rest of it. I wanted something full on right then. So don't withhold the wealth of the Dharma. Also, another thing that can happen with withholding the wealth of the Dharma, we might hold back out of fear. I think this is really, really interesting. Sometimes there might be situations, maybe people are talking about the Dharma or talking about a topic where there's a lot of false views around, or somebody, you know, in our workplace or whatever, being treated not very well. And we hold back when a Dharma perspective, we don't even have to say it's Buddhism, but that perspective could make all the difference, but we hold back through fear. Well, that's withholding the wealth of the Dharma. And one of the qualities of a Bodhisattva, that when you read in the Mahayana, they're always really confident. You know, they're people who can handle themselves. So, number three, it is a bad thing to punish and to refuse to concede repentance. It is a bad thing to punish and to refuse to concede repentance, or to refuse to accept apology. It's a bad thing to punish and not accept apology. So, that, yes, this could be also be translated as holding on to grudges and not accepting an apology from others, not being open to apology from others. And this downfall is referring really to holding on to resentments and not forgiving people when they've harmed us. Sometimes, of course, we think someone has harmed us, but they haven't. The harm is in our own minds. Sometimes we can be really touchy and quick to take offence and be very resentful of others and easily find fault with others and blame others. But it's all our stuff. It's not them. It's always our stuff, whatever anybody else does. Again, this is an absolutely basic downfall from Bodhisattva aspiration. Well, it's a basic downfall from the first precept and from the ninth of the 10 Dharmachari precepts. Resentment, grudge holding, fault finding, you know, feeling justified in our negativity. They deserve it. They need to learn. I'm not going to forgive them, they'll take advantage. So if we suffer from any of this, whether outside, you know, with people outside or within the Sangha, whatever someone has done or not done, the entire Buddhist tradition is very clear. We need to deal with our ill will, our resentment, our grudge holding. We've got to deal with it. It's our responsibility. It's our stuff. And we need to get rid of it. I've seen people destroying their lives, even Buddhists, I'm sorry to say, destroying their lives through holding on to resentment and grudges and blame. Sometimes people want the person, you know, who they regard as having harmed them, to acknowledge their fault first, or they need to, you know, before they do anything about it, or that they should be punished in some way. Then they can forgive. But life and love doesn't work like that. doesn't work like that at all. Healing suffering doesn't work like that. There is no healing through punishment. You know, it's interesting, you know, we sort of have this feeling, you know, when I feel hurt by somebody, I feel that if I can get them, what's happened, there's something wrong with the universe. Something's happened where I'm out of sync with things. You know, it's as if something badly wrong with the universe. And I feel that I can have parity again if I can just strike back at that other person. Well, that's eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. And there is no spiritual progress with that. There's no healing through that. What we have to do is recognise that this happens in life. People hurt people. And not sort of say that cynically, oh, well, what do you expect from other people? But this is what happens. This is dukkha. This is what deluded human beings do. And we need to move to a place of forgiveness. Forgiving, in a sense, life itself. Forgiving life itself. That's what we need to do. This is what happens. Understanding that person. Understanding the forces that have brought them to that. Even sort of reflecting, you know, well, if I'd had a life like theirs, I probably would do the same. So we need to be bigger, and we need to move to a much bigger place. We need to move to this place of bodhicitta. It was very interesting reflecting on Dada Rinpoche's life. I mean, you know, had enemies, people really out to get him, and you know, there was one man who was just appalling to him, really rude, worked against him. He died, and Dada Rinpoche was asked to perform his funeral because, you know, he was a Tibetan Lama, and this man was a Tibetan, and somebody needed to do it. Of course Rinpoche did it. He did the funeral. He did the death rites and so on, without any kind of negativity or anything like that. I've seen it with Bhante. I've met order members who've written appalling things about Bhante in Shabda, the order magazine, and then they sort it out, go to see him. And I said, oh, how did it go with Bhante? Oh, he was brilliant. He was fantastic. So kind. I thought, blimey, you know, if he'd written stuff like that about me, I'd never want to see you again. you know, just, you know, there's just no place for that. You know, you're just bigger than all that negativity. It's difficult moving towards this. I mean, I love talking about it, but I find it very hard, I have to admit. And perhaps where we start is by genuinely letting go of the little things, you know, those irritations that happen on almost daily basis. You know, if we're always getting uptight about the little things that people do, and we can't forgive those, well, what can we do about the big things? You know, if we can't deal with those daily things that we meet, well, you know, we're not going to be able to deal with the bigger things. So we need to move to metta and wisdom with all this. It might take time, but we at least need to move in that direction. There's so many problems that come up in the Sangha because people hold grudges, hold on to hurts, get very bothered about position, and it affects everybody. I mean, when there are these holding on to things, it ripples out, you know, and just affects the whole centre and the whole Sangha, and goes on and on and on. It's so destructive. And if only the people involved could have just put it down, just forgiven, put straw on the mud, as the Buddha says when in his own discourse on how to deal with disharmony, put straw on mud. And he said, how do you put straw on mud? Everybody admits their faults. Everybody admits their faults to each other. That's the first thing you do. Admit your fault, whatever it is, whatever your fault is. Nobody is justified in their fault, putting straw on mud. So instead of, you know, holding on to grudges, there's confession of faults and there's forgiveness of faults. I remember when there was a sort of period many years ago when there was some argy-bargy in the order. Bhante said he'd often reflected on that line from William Blake, which he thought should really be a motto for the Sangha. mutual forgiveness for each vice, such are the gates of paradise. Mutual forgiveness for each vice, such are the gates of paradise. You know, we really would be living in paradise if we were like that for one another all the time. Fourthly, and briefly, it is a bad thing to give up the Mahayana while still pretending to belong to it. It is a bad thing to give up the Mahayana while still pretending to belong to it. This would seem to mean that we use all the Mahayana words about love and compassion and bodhisattvas and forgiveness and so on, but it's just words. It's just a show. We might even use the language of caring and so on, but it's just words. It could just be a lot of sentimentality, but no real action. No real Dharma life, no real metta in deeds. It's words, it's talk. Bhante said he has met technically Mahayana monks, full of reference to the Bodhisattva path, the Bodhisattva vow. He said, but they're not living that life. You know, they're very comfortable in their monastery and, you know, reciting and debating the Mahayana sutras and doing their liturgies, but they're not living it. And he's met Theravadins who don't use that language. They use the language of metta. But they are living the life of real service to others. So he says you can get Mahayana Hinayanists and Hinayana Mahayanists. In other words, it's nothing to do with the words you're using or the doctrine you espouse. It's behaviour. We always need to look at the man, not the jargon. Look at the behaviour. That is what's important. Not the jargon, it's the behaviour, it's the man, it's the woman. Make sure that we really live a life of metta, generosity and real awareness of one another and intensify that within the Sangha, within the spiritual community. That we're making sure that more and more of us are connecting in and through that. And then I think there's the possibility of something very special arising between us, some quality of bodhicitta, which is very attractive, which will really be the Mahayana. Mahayana means the great way. And in the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, it's called the Mahayana because it carries a vast number of beings on its way. It's open to everybody. You learn to connect with anybody and everybody. There isn't a special kind of person who can be a Buddhist, who can raise the bodhicitta, who can go for refuge. I mean, it could be anybody, anywhere. And that's what I'm going to go into tomorrow.